This podcast is brought to you by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of audiobooks, with more than 100,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature, including fiction, nonfiction, and periodicals. For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audiblepodcast.com/paranormal. That's audiblepodcast.com/paranormal. Thanks, Audible. Hey, everyone. Just a quick note before we get started on our show, which I'm sure you'll like. First of all, happy Halloween. And secondly, please, everybody out east, please stay safe. This Hurricane Sandy is terrifying. So we're really hoping for the best for everybody in the eastern part of the country. Believe it or not, where I'm sitting now in Ohio, northeastern Ohio, is also affected by this. Now, by no means to the same extent that those good folks out east are. My goodness. But we're affected enough that things like schools are being called off, events are being canceled, and it's touched our world in a small way. We originally had scheduled on Tuesday, October 30th at the Learned Owl Bookstore in Hudson, Ohio. I was going to sign some books and also record some campfire stories. That has now been postponed to November 9th, Friday, November 9th at 6 p.m. The details over at jimherald.com. Just wanted to make sure we've tried to tweet it out and Facebook it out and put it out on the site. But the last thing we want to have happen is anybody show up and there's no event. So we wanted to also mention it to this audience. And by way of invitation to folks that didn't know about it, November 9th, the Learned Owl in Hudson, Ohio. And you can find all the details at jimherald.com. And two last words. Happy Halloween to everybody. We hope you have a great one. And again, to our friends out east, please be careful and stay safe. We're thinking of you. God bless. And now on to the Paranormal Podcast.
This is the Paranormal Podcast with Jim Harold.
Welcome to the Paranormal Podcast. I'm Jim Harold, and so glad to be with you once again. And we have one of our most popular guests today, and I think that you will thoroughly enjoy it. Our guest is Philip Coppens, and he has a new book out. It's called The Lost Civilization Enigma, a new inquiry into the existence of ancient cities, cultures, and peoples who predate recorded history. And a little bit about Philip. Now, he's been on the show many times. Of course, we know him from Ancient Aliens, where we'll see him on TV, but he's also an author and an investigative journalist, ranging from the world of politics to ancient history and mystery. He co-hosts a Spirit Revolution radio show with his wife, Kathleen McGowan, and is a frequent contributor to Nexus Magazine and Atlantis Rising Magazine. Since 1995, he has lectured extensively and has appeared in a number of television and DVD documentaries, as we said, including Ancient Aliens, the series. He's the author of 9 English language books, and this is the most recent one, The Lost Civilization Enigma. Philip Coppens, welcome back to the Paranormal Podcast.
Welcome for having me on, Jim.
Well, thank you. And I must say, you are by far one of our most popular guests. So great to have you again. So I know you certainly have been interested in this area. Why did you decide to write this particular book at this particular time exclusively on lost civilizations?
Well, because obviously the show of Ancient Aliens is asking the question whether or not we're alone. But I also think there's another question there, which is whether we're the first or not. And actually, the History Channel, together with Prometheus, the production company of Ancient Aliens, actually tried to do a show which was actually, you know, about lost civilizations. And it was very hard to actually get this visualized. You know, lost civilizations by default are lost, so there's very little graphic visual evidence about them. And what is left quite often is gray rubble, ruins. So it's very hard to get this visually appealing. But I think it's one of the great unaddressed issues, and it's definitely something which, together with the ancient alien question, is a subject matter which science somehow fails to adapt. The part and parcel, really, of the same problem, which is that we're locked inside of this framework that 6,000 years ago, we somehow were able to rise from above primitive cultures and somehow were able to develop civilization. But the truth of the matter is that civilization is far older. And so really the picture is that even though the ancient alien question and lost civilization seem to be two separate problems or two separate aspects of who we are, quite often they go together. For example, when we take the king lists of ancient Egypt, Manetho, the Palermo Papyrus, all of these speak about a great past of ancient Egypt. They say that the gods ruled over ancient Egypt roughly from 25,000 year onwards. Now, the gods clearly is a non-human intelligence for them. And they also say that even though they ruled over ancient Egypt at that moment in time wasn't physically located in Egypt, i.e. the current Egypt, that it was somewhere else, and that from there people came to Egypt over, you know, some point in time. Now, the very few people who have done so and have looked into this, that the ancient Egyptians described this landscape, and one of them was a professor called Kuhn, who was located at Harvard in the 1950s, if I'm not mistaken. And Kuhn basically said that when he was reading the descriptions of this land of Osiris, it was so unlike ancient Egypt today and in the past and 25,000 years ago. It was tree-like, it had a completely different feel to it, a completely different landscape than what ancient Egypt had ever offered, or that Egypt as a geographical location had ever offered. And so what he said was, this is clearly somewhere else. And this is what the ancient Egyptians are saying as well. When you start adding all of these things together, you somehow end up with this possibility that 25,000 years ago, the ancient Egyptians were somewhere else, and that they have this continuous memory from there onwards to the present day. Now, the greatest lost civilization, of course, or the most mythical of lost civilizations is that of Atlantis. And this is, again, typifying, I think, the current problem which we are facing. Plato wrote about Atlantis as a piece of history. He put it in a book all about history. Yet somehow science has said that this is an idealized state, that this isn't something which Plato wrote about as history. And so when you confront these modern historians and scientists with, well, Plato said it was history, they say, well, it's a literary device. He didn't really mean it. But everything indicates that it is. And Plato in his own time had skeptics, people who simply couldn't believe the fact that their own town of Athens was thousands of years older. And so what they did was they jumped on a boat, they sailed to Egypt, they spoke to the priests of the temple where Solon had spoken to and had received this information from Atlantis. And basically these priests agreed that the temple columns, which had these inscriptions and these tales, were at that moment in time, i.e. roughly the 4th century BC, still standing. And that indeed the story of Atlantis was something which the ancient Egyptians were familiar with and had passed on to the ancient Greeks of Plato's time. So they came back to Athens and basically had to concede that Plato's story about this lost civilization was indeed true. Now, you know, there is so much information in there, and when you start to put it all together, you can come up with very basic scenarios. Nothing to do, this isn't a theory. This is basically putting all the ancient accounts together. When Plato writes about how Atlantis is somehow linked with Kronos, it is known that Kronos equaled the Egyptian deity Seb, S-E-B. Mm-hmm. And Seb is one of these deities who ruled over this distant land in a remote past thousands and thousands of years ago. And all of a sudden, you know, all of these things fall into place. And it's really, I find remarkable, and this is, you know, the situation I found myself to be in, that if we take our ancestors' account as is, as they are, and we put them together, we get a very interesting depiction of our ancient history. Yet scientists refuse to look at this because they all explain it away. Now, there is, of course, you know, always the odd one out. And in this case, I think really due respect needs to go to one woman called Dr. Mary Settegast in her book, Plato Prehistorian, in which she basically says everything which we know about this period, 25,000 BC, you know, then thereabouts, when mankind was doing things like the cave paintings of Lascaux in France, Altamira in northern Spain, everything else about that period which archaeologists have identified, when you compare this with what Plato writes about Atlantis, they match. Now, clearly they don't match when we have this view of Atlantis as somehow, you know, this is a high technological civilization, the way it's sometimes depicted in channeled New Age publications. But what we know about Atlantis from what Plato wrote about it, what archaeologists are digging up, those two things match. And that, I think, is a stunning discovery. Yet it is something which, you know, the absolute majority of scientists absolutely refuse to look at. And as such, we are being denied a large section of our history.
Well, it is a fascinating topic, particularly why science won't look at this in a more serious manner. I talk about that right after this message on the Paranormal Podcast. This podcast is brought to you by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of audiobooks, with more than 100,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature and featuring audio versions of many New York Times bestsellers. For our listeners, Audible is offering a free audiobook to give you a chance to try out their service. One audiobook to consider is Proof of Heaven, a neurosurgeon's near-death experience and journey into the afterlife. So, for this or another free audiobook of your choice, go to audiblepodcast.com/paranormal. That's audiblepodcast.com/paranormal. You know that I love Audible. I love the spoken word since I was a small child. Loved talk radio. See what kind of kid I was. But certainly, I got to tell you, Audible is a godsend for anybody who loves books, particularly if you find yourself commuting a lot. If you're a big gym rat or you like to walk around the neighborhood, really, I guess, come to think of it, anybody who has to do anything, whether it's clean their house or exercise or commute, Audible is a panacea to all of it, because you can do something maybe you don't like as much. Now, I know some people are really into exercise. I happen to not be one of those people, but nevertheless, even if you're doing something you don't enjoy, you'll enjoy it much more with the company of Audible. And this is a great book. I'm really interested in this. I want to try to get this gentleman on one of the programs. Ibn Alexander, a neurosurgeon who started out as a skeptic and now believes there is something to the afterlife and the fact that he says he experienced it. So please check it out. It's audiblepodcast.com/paranormal. It's audiblepodcast.com/paranormal. We would appreciate it if you would show them they make the right choice going with the Paranormal Podcast. And we thank you, and we thank Audible.
Be sure to follow Jim on Facebook, Twitter, and Google+. Find all the links at jimherald.com. Now back to the Paranormal Podcast.
We're back on the Paranormal Podcast. Our guest is Philip Coppens. You know him from Ancient Aliens and his many books. His new book is A New Inquiry into the Existence of Ancient Cities, Cultures, and Peoples Who Predate Recorded History. Philip, before the break, you were talking about evidence that is coming to the fore, but yet the reluctance of most mainstream scientists to look at it seriously. Why do you think that is?
Well, because we're locked into a paradigm. You know, we're locked in so many paradigms, and we have really no means of escape anymore, I think, from these paradigms. And it's interesting times we live in, and there is no easy answer to that question. To a large extent, it has to do with the fact that science is repetitive. And by that, I mean that, you know, an awful lot of disciplines go from professor to student who becomes professor, who has students who, you know, the cycle continues. And each one repeats pretty much what their predecessor has said. And there is a very interesting case there in the opening parts of the book, in which I delve into the story of Glozel. Glozel is a very small French village near Vichy. And in the 1920s, a farmer made a discovery which at that time everybody assumed was going to change the paradigm. Everybody thought that history was going to be rewritten, that either writing came much earlier and that it actually developed in Western Europe rather than in the Middle East, and that this would push back pretty much all of these things by several thousands of years. And this paradigm, you know, shift never really happened, because the evidence in the end, when it was actually analyzed, never supported these conclusions. But simply the fear, and this is the key thing, the absolute fear, the agony which science had, that their cherished beliefs were going to be upset, caused an absolute furore amongst them. They went as far as character assassinations. They went as far as trying to basically falsify the evidence to make it work for them. When they were caught red-handed, they absolutely denied it. They went as far as arresting the poor farmer, Emile Fredin, who was 16, 17, 18 years old, on suspicions of faking it all, simply because they wanted to get him on a plane whereby they could say, well, we don't need to look at this man anymore because he's been arrested for fraudulent activities to do with these artifacts, while the actual court case found no evidence whatsoever of forgery. Now, one of the key people involved in this horrific saga, and it is horrific, people like Alice Girard has written an entire book about the Glozell affair. There's several thousands of words on it in the opening chapters of my book. But Dorothy Garrow was an Oxford professor who was involved in this, and she was one of the key people who were trying to basically plant evidence which was going to make the Glozell affair disappear. And she was caught red-handed by the people involved. Basically, what happened was that the professors involved entered the site before the doors were officially unlocked. And when the doors were unlocked by the people having the key, they found these people already inside and basically said, what are you doing here? And there's an awful lot of finger pointing. There's photographic evidence of some of this finger pointing, specifically a finger being pointed towards Dorothy Garrow, who afterwards went back to Oxford, pretended her nose bled for several decades, and each told her students that there was nothing to Glozell, that all of this was a hoax. And ever since, Oxford professors, without doing any factual work on the case whatsoever, have just copied her opinion, which, is definitely unique within the fields of science. But because it comes from Oxford, it is somehow deemed to be more important than anything which anybody else is talking about when it comes to Glozell. And that's a very sad state of affairs. And it's just one example out of several about how, these things get done. There are statistics pretty much about how pretty much an awful lot of archaeology is done in conditions which at best are below par. My joke is that archaeologists are getting away with writing reports about archaeological excavations 20 years after these have happened. There is one statistic for Italy, which had such things as the Roman Empire, where of all the excavations which have happened, 80% of which have never been written up, which basically means that 80% of what archaeologists have done has been completely, become useless from a scientific point of view. There are artifacts sitting in museums all across Italy whereby nobody knows where they came from, whether or not they're important, and all of these things because the archaeologists involved have never written up their reports. Name me one other job whereby you can go to your boss and say, I have a report to write, don't I? The boss says yes, and you give as your answer as to when this report will be written, oh, maybe in the next 20 years. Your boss will not let you get away with that. Yet somehow archaeologists are able to get away with that. And this is really, the greatest cause, I think, of why we're in this mess. The mess is to do with the fact that archaeologists, by and large, are lazy. They are very prone to pretend that they are more than experts at digging. They make grandiose statements about everything else, and they don't let other experts in. This is a serious problem. When an archaeologist, for example, goes into the construction methodology of the Great Pyramid, you would think that building experts and building project managers would be called in to provide peer review. But when these people give their opinion, the archaeologists mock them, saying, what do you know about archaeology? And the answer is nothing, but they know about building techniques and, you know, building extremely large building projects. And yet this is something which archaeology and science as a whole refuses to address, this interdisciplinary approach. And so what we're left with is basically continuous rehashing of things which we already know, and of praising hallelujahs as to how previous professors have done great jobs. But there is no innovation. There is no, you know, there is no pushing anything forward. And one of the things about ancient aliens, which you know, we're beginning to see, is that because it has an audience of people who are quite often at university and don't really know what to do, all of a sudden you have people in even in high schools who are basically beginning to challenge the status quo, who are beginning to say, well, how do you know that? How did we get into this paradigm? And people who are refusing to take the paradigm for granted. And I think that's great, because, you know, it really, science has become, unfortunately, a very ivory tower approach. And it is only through people and largely democratic movement who's pushing them to say, we want to have proper answers. We want to see you reasoning these things out. We are going to be your peer review. That is really the only approach, I think, whereby we're going to get more answers, and we're going to get closer to a true account as to where we came from and what we are as mankind as a whole.
I would like to talk to you about some of the specific cases and some of the different areas in the world that you've done some work on in this particular book. Now, no discussion of lost civilizations would be started or finished unless you covered Atlantis. And you have some interesting information how Atlantis really was. It's not a myth. It was a real civilization. Tell us what you found.
Well, basically, I told you the principles already, which is that in the eyes of Plato and everybody in the 4th century, it was indeed an account coming from Egypt. The ancient right. Egyptians were absolutely convinced that there was this civilization called Atlantis outside of the Straits of Hercules, which in this case has to be interpreted as Straits of Gibraltar. They said that there was an island there, and that beyond that was a bigger sea, and that beyond that was a real continent. Now, that is America. And as strange as it may seem, there is clear evidence in the book, which I point out on a number of occasions, that there was indeed transoceanic contact going back at least 5,000 years between Europe and the New World. Now, in the case of Atlantis, what we're looking for is basically a lost civilization in the Atlantic. Well, 10,000 years ago, when Atlantis is said to have disappeared, what we're facing with is the end of the last ice age. The sea levels are extremely lower than they are now. And there is actually one location in the Atlantic which currently is under about 200 yards of seawater, but which at that moment in time would have been above sea level. And it is the work of one Dutch amateur archaeologist and amateur Egyptologist, but a great researcher and far superior in his research than many Egyptologists will ever have done, called Willem Zitman, who I'm also very pleased to call my friend. And he very early on was looking at these centers of civilization, Teotihuacan, Tiwanaku, Giza, Stonehenge. In three of these occasions, Stonehenge is the exclusion because we know very little about it. They are all linked with places where the gods are said to have convened and or descended to create a new age. Mm-hmm. In the case of Giza and Teotihuacan, the pyramids and temples there are laid out in the shape of Orion's belt. In both cases, they are linked with mythical creation. In the case of Egypt, Horus was identified with magical birth, the magical offspring of Osiris and Isis. In the case of the Mayan civilization, a point just south of the Orion's belt was deemed to be the magical cauldron out of which creation was made. So all of these are already extremely interesting. Why would on two continents, out of thousands of constellations, three stars be grouped either linked with magical birth and also somehow apparently associated with pyramids and pyramid building. So that is already one statistical question which, you know, science basically says they never have to address, because they know that there is no such thing as transoceanic contact. No matter how much evidence there is to the contrary, they just simply know. And so when Sittman was playing with these four structures, these four locations, he mapped them on a projection of the globe called the Mercator projection, which is one of the old ones around, named after Mercator, who was a Belgian, Flemish, basically mapmaker. And what he did was he realized that there was something to this layout, this positioning of these four locations. And what he did was, if you can see them visually in front of you, he basically dropped a longitudinal axis from Stonehenge that hit the 30th parallel upon which the line from the Giza Plateau is situated. He flipped it to the other side, to the left, and ended up in a place in the Atlantic Ocean, which indeed 10,000 years ago was above sea level. He identified that when you start connecting all of these sites by lines, the ensuing result is actually a depiction of the constellation of Orion, and that Orion's belt is located in the Atlantic Ocean, again at a place where at one point in time it would have been above sea level. So that was one aspect. At the same time, partly actually why I began to become interested in lost civilizations was that in 1994, actually a bit earlier than that, 1993, I became exposed to work by a Belgian historian called Marcel Mastek. And this is a very long story which is related in the book, but in short, what he found was that the megalithic civilization of Northern Europe, specifically in France and England, was focused on certain places, and places like Sens, and that they incorporated a network of roads, a network of ditches, which were, in his opinion, and later was proved to be on the ground when he went there, supposed to be filled with water. That this was the true megalithic civilization, which was in you know, things like Stonehenge and Avebury were a part of this. Things like Karnak in Brittany were a part of this as well. And when he mapped everything which he had found over a number of years, you know, doing painstaking analysis, he would quite often leave Belgium, drive down south just to check out something on the ground. Because in those days, the 1980s, there was no such thing as Google Maps or anything like that. You know, he had to jump in his car and do it. And quite often he had to be back by a certain point in time during the night, because he actually was taking care of his sick wife throughout most of that period in time. And anyway, what he found was that this megalithic civilization, which he had found, had certain dimensions, which he had, you know, which he had mapped, and he spoke about this to his fellow historians in school, and basically they said, well, you don't seem to know where this one is going, so but have you ever tried to map it on Atlantis? And Marcel was one of those people who basically said, Atlantis is a myth, right? And his fellow colleagues basically said, well, look into it, see what's what. And as he said, you know, to his own utter astonishment and stomach-churning conclusion was that indeed the dimensions which Plato had given for Atlantis were the same as the one he had found. Now, time-wise, what he had found was not matching with Plato. Plato had pushed this to 9000 BC, and what he found was that traditional carbon dating suggested this was 2000-3000 BC. So there's two possibilities here. Either all the carbon dating results of the megalithic structures are wrong, and because there are so many, this is, at this moment in time, not the likeliest conclusion. The megalithic civilization probably is roughly from 6,000 to 1,200 BC. However, what seems to, or what might have happened, is that indeed people from this continent called previously Atlantis ended up or had already been in continental Europe. And when Atlantis basically disappeared, they seemed to have built a copy of Atlantis on the plains of France, and a smaller copy on the plains of Wiltshire, incorporating such structures as Stonehenge and Avebury. So all of that is beginning to add some more meat to the bones to the story of Atlantis. It seems that Atlantis to our ancestors was far more important than, you know, we have definitely believed for a great number of decades. And also it seems that the story of Atlantis might shed new interesting lights and, you know, if not great innovation, great innovative lights on the megalithic civilization, which is a civilization which really dominates to this very moment in time large sections of France, Britain, other parts of Europe, and of which we know very little. Again, archaeologists have only approached this in great isolation. There are books about Stonehenge, there are books about Avebury, but there are very few archaeologists who really take both of them into account and try to paint a greater picture. And one of those who actually do that, the likes of Professor Barry Cunliffe, begin to realize that what we have here is indeed an extremely great civilization, and a civilization which actually seemed to have relied greatly on boats, which then clearly, you know, brings into another aspect, which is that boats can go on the sea and can sail offshore as well, and might have actually been used into going as far as North America, which is also something which I touch upon in the book, because, again, classic standoff. 3000 BC, we find that there is mining of copper in North America. 500,000 tons of copper are mined. Only 35,000 tons are actually accounted for in North America. Nobody knows what happened to pretty much 450,000 tons of copper. Where did it go? At the same time, copper, vital ingredient together with tin for bronze. The Bronze Age goes in Europe roughly from 3000 to 1200 BC. In Europe, everybody knows that copper was used, but nobody really knows where it comes from. Sure, there have been mines which have been identified in Europe, but a large section of copper in Europe simply has an unknown origin. It is not known where it comes from. Well, when we tie those two together, when we find that the way mining tools were used, the type of mining tools, all the details to do with mining activity, that they correspond, that they are identical between Northeast America and Europe, what we seem to have is a logical conclusion, which is that mining activity in Northeast America happened and that the copper was transported to old Europe. It finished in America at the same time when the Bronze Age finished in Europe, 1200 BC. So all of these things are staring us in the face, but because we have paradigms which say that Columbus was the first to cross, we simply are unwilling or incapable of embracing a different perspective on humanity than I think is the proper perspective on humanity. And that's, once again, a great shame.
I do want to ask you about lost technology, but a couple of other places that you talk about, now you talked about Europe a little bit in the interaction with North America, but this, the Bosnian pyramids, and when you think of the pyramids, for example, you think of Egypt, but these Bosnian pyramids, this is particularly a fascinating development.
Yes, I mean, you know, pyramids have become a worldwide phenomenon. Right now, associating Egypt with pyramids is something which truly belongs in the 19th century. The oldest pyramids in the world, accepted by everybody, i.e. science, are in Peru, Corral, 3200 BC. The oldest pyramid, sorry, the greatest pyramid in mass is Cholula in Mexico. So Egypt has lost its prime call as being the lands of pyramids. They're pretty much everywhere. In China, they have been confirmed since roughly 1995. They prefer to call them imperial tombs, but they are, guess what, pyramids. In the case of Bosnia, however, what we have is a wonderful combination of two sad events. One of them is the fact that Bosnia, even though it's situated in Europe, is more Muslim than it is Christian. It is part of a country which, to some extent, is still under UN control after the atrocities which happened there in the 1990s. And as a result of which, you really find that it is treated pretty much as a colony of the West. And so what happened was that in 2005, a Bosnian expat called Samos Manigic, who spent most of his time in Houston, where he had a metal company, steel company rather. He came because he had a PhD in mine scientists. He had always published his books in Bosnian. And during the promotion of one book on Mayan pyramids and what the mines stood for, basically somebody in the audience said you should go to a place called Visoko, about 20 minutes drive outside of the capital, Sarajevo. And I want to show you something and have your opinion on it. And what he saw there was basically a pyramid. He began to do some analysis. The geophys basically came back and said, this is encouraging. You should continue. Ever since 2006, Sam has been digging. And quite often against, an international opposition of people who basically pretend that it doesn't exist or who think that it's a scam. And this is simply not the case. Again, in the book, I go into some of the detail. But one of the things which I find truly appalling is the way skeptics are able to get away, not necessarily with murder, but definitely with character assassination, which, as it has the word assassination in it, to some extent, is considered to be murder. And the way they go about it is this. In 2008, Sam Osmanagić organized the first international conference on the Bosnian pyramids. The likes of Dr. Ibrahim Mohamed Ali, who is currently the Minister of Antiquities, the successor to Zahi Hawass, at that moment in time, the Dean of Incheon's University in Cairo, the Dean of Archaeology of Cairo University was there, the person who has redone the Alexandrian Library, obviously in Alexandria, was there. People like Dr. Mona Agat, various Egyptologists were there, about 30 on Egyptologists themselves. From China were the two leading archaeologists, just when it comes to the imperial tombs. There were various scientists from Russia, from other countries previously known as Eastern Bloc countries. The conclusions in 2008, 2 years in, 4 years ago, basically said that this was encouraging, that there should be continuous strive for it. And there were actually some people on the conference, the likes of a geologist who had done extensive research, who had actually been recommended by Dr. Zahi Hawass to come to Visoko and do this study, Dr. Ali Barakat. He basically said that the pyramids were man-made, that they were not natural phenomena. And so what we had in 2008 was this consensus. Yes, some of them who were involved said these are man-made. As a consensus view amongst 50 scientists, clearly it's not that easy. Basically, 2 years in, they said, yes, we need to continue. And we think that they are going to be turning up as man-made. Those conclusions were written down, were signed off by everybody. And when somebody tried to enter this, for example, on Wikipedia, a skeptical guy, Doug Weller, who claims to be a bad archaeologist and who truly is, he feels that bad archaeology is there to expose the bad archaeologist, but basically, he's the one practicing it. He basically put this conference on par with creationist conferences, which were happening in parts of the United States, trying to show that the world was 6,000 years old. Now, it is a disingenuous approach. You cannot say that the likes of Mohammed Ibrahim Ali and various other of these people are respected scientists. If that is your take, which is, by the way, Weller's take, then you have to accept that what they reached at that international conference is also something which is definitely worthy of reporting on quite a mundane publication platform such as Wikipedia. Yet for 4 years, Doc Weller has done everything in his might to keep it off there and tries to pretend as if these pyramids are a natural formation. Since 2008, pretty much there has been a divide between the West, who pretends that their nose is bleeding, who pretends that this is all a hoax, and the East, who is pretty much, with every shovel involved, with every scientific analysis coming out of the pyramid complex. It is now more than abundantly clear that this is a man-made structure. The perfection in execution, the way wherever a shovel is put, where you can see that once the topsoil is removed, you are indeed confronted with a man-made structure. All of this is basically showing you that Bosnia has the greatest pyramid currently on planet Earth. And what is coming out this year out of Bosnia is actually that the Bosnian pyramid might also be by far the oldest. In June, a sample was taken from the Bosnian Pyramid of the Sun, which is the largest pyramid in that valley complex, and it was carbon dated by the University of Kiev. And the carbon dating results said that the structure was 24,800 years old, give or take 200 years, i.e. roughly 25,000 years ago. And that is really a phenomenal dating. Now, you know, as strange as that may seem, all of a sudden, you know, again, earlier on I was talking about Dr. Mary Sattakast and what she found, you know, about Plato prehistorian. 25,000 years ago, people in Europe were not primitives. Our ancestors weren't primitives. They were doing cave paintings like Lascaux. They had civilization. For the construction of a pyramid wasn't something which was, you know, to them an impossibility. It is merely us who has continuously tried to push everything into the 6,000 years old framework. Stonehenge is another great example. You know, Stonehenge is coming up with carbon dating results which show that parts of Stonehenge go back to 8,000 BC, which is roughly 5,000 years older than the traditional dating of Stonehenge. But, you know, 5,000 years old, all of a sudden we're finding that Stonehenge is potentially 10,000 years old. It's double its date. And what people are doing constantly is pretending as if what is being discovered there is not part of Stonehenge, and they're trying to explain away how the 8,000-year-old dates seem somehow not relevant to what was going on in Stonehenge. But there are, you know, again, a minority of people who basically say, hold on, what you guys are pretending is 3,000 BC, you know, these things we see in the 8,000 BC layer as well. So how can you pretend that you know, the 8,000 BC layer has nothing to do with the 3,000 BC layer? And again, basically what it seems to have been is, you know, what history seems to need to do is, you know, when you go into these posh restaurants and you are eating lobster or whatever, they quite often serve you these serviettes now, and they're very tiny, and then they put boiling water on it, and then they expand, and then you can wash your hands. Well, this is really what I think needs to happen with the way archaeologists and scientists are currently doing. They have somehow pushed or tried to push everything into the 6,000 years, and all it needs is a bit of boiling water, maybe on some of the archaeological hands. They're not too severely, because they need to then use them, you know, to write their reports. And basically let go of it, let go of this imaginary boundary of 6,000 years old. You know, the old statement of like how we no longer believe that the world is 6,000 years old, but yet civilization somehow is 6,000 years old. And the Inquisition, i.e. the, you know, aspects or science as an establishment, as an institution, continues to defend that civilization is 6,000 years old and that everything before is somehow primitive and not worthy. And that is really the problem. It is really a problem which I think, you know, we need to address, because right now, certain things like Stonehenge are explained away, and things like the Bosnian pyramids are being ridiculed by half the world, and by the other half of the world seen as a major revelation.
As we close out here, you know, we think about buildings and structures and those kind of things as indicators of lost civilizations. But one thing that fascinates me is when you take a look at something like the Antikythera device and technologies that seem like they were almost out of place, if you accept the common archaeological narrative. Can you talk to us a little bit in closing about the role of lost technology and some interesting lost technologies that you discovered or rediscovered?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, the Antikythera device stands there as a giant. It's seen by sections of the modern scientific community as the first computer, which, you know, basically the Antikythera device is something which was found in a shipwreck in 1901 or 1902. Ever since, it has been studied. For years, it sat in a museum without anybody really realizing what it was. But in recent decades, roughly the last, I would say 20, 30, to some extent 40 years in the case of a few isolated scientists, people have been studying this device. And in essence, it's a scale model. It's a scale model of our solar system, throwing in our moon, throwing in a few information bits about the zodiac, a few information about stars. And it seems to have been a device which just sat somewhere. You pushed it into motion, and then all of a sudden, it was like this miniature, you know, representation of how our universe worked. It came from Greece. Nobody really knows who made it. It seems to have involved astronomical information which was coming from Babylonia. And only recently has it been studied in such a way that it has really pushed people into accepting that the Greeks knew such things. But there is, you know, other evidence out there as well. And I point out the extremely long and detailed study which was done by the likes of Robert Temple in a book called Crystal Sun. And what he identified there was basically that inside museums all across the world, including the British Museum, there are lenses, and that these lenses were used as part of early telescope activity. Basically, our ancestors used these glass spheres to look towards the moon in an effort to try and find out whether they could see something on there. And he actually began to delve and began to realize that our ancestors wrote and spoke about this, but that sometimes translators of these ancient texts really distorted what our ancestors were saying. And he lists one example of a guy called Kramer who was confronted, I think, with a book of Strabo. And basically, he saw something in it in Greek. The literal translation of this meant glass spheres. He basically said, but our ancestors don't have telescopes to look at these planetary objects. So he decided to change, you know, he should have written in his translation glass spheres. Instead, he wrote tubes. And basically, it became nonsensical. Nobody understood anything of what was going on because nobody was studying the original Greek text. They were all studying Kramer's translation or using Kramer's translation. And it really was only when Temple went back to the original source and actually looked at what Kramer had written that he basically said, you know, was confronted with the fact, and I'm paraphrasing here, Kramer basically said, well, we know the Greeks are stupid. They couldn't have had telescopes. So I've changed glass spheres into something else because it is pretty much known that the Greeks didn't have telescopes. When there is evidence sitting inside museums which clearly shows that our ancestors did have lenses, did have glass spheres, to which they looked towards the sky. And when you read what the ancient Greeks are saying about these observations, you know, about things they saw on the surface of the moon, it conforms with what early observations of the moon happened through glass spheres in modern times. But again, we refuse ourselves to have a larger part in history, and we refuse to give our ancestors, you know, technological advances. And I find it very funny, you know, when in part of the problem with the ancient alien question is, of course, that scientific establishment says that, well, these ancient alien theorists, they will all say that our ancestors were stupid and that they needed extraterrestrial help to create some of this technology. Well, in the case of the Antikythera device, in the case of the glass spheres, there is no such aspect of any alien aspect or alien intervention or alien hand-holding in the creation of these artifacts. And it is science who's refusing to give our ancestors the technology they clearly had, technology which is sitting inside museums, but which is being downplayed by the scientific mindset and the scientists involved. It's not us, it's them.
So, Philip, obviously you're heavy into the promotion of this book, and I'm sure it's going to be a fantastic success, as all your books are. What else do you have going on these days?
Oh, so many things. Clearly there is the filming of Ancients Alien Season 5, which is happening as we speak. I actually have an Atlas of Ancient Enigmas coming out, which is a collection of articles which are on my website, reworked in a slightly different fashion and updated, which is going to come out in March of next year. And then I'm actually working on a book for release, more than likely in October or November of 2013, to do with pyramids and pretty much focusing on the why of the pyramid. I think, you know, too many times people have been focusing on the when and the how. How were the pyramids built? How old are they? These are very interesting questions, but nobody or very few people are looking at the why. And whenever the why was addressed, it is sporadic. It's information which you can find in some books, but it's a paragraph here or a paragraph there. The why is also something which we can glean from building pyramids ourselves, which is something which is happening in various countries, specifically in the former Soviet Union, parts of Russia and Ukraine. So all of these things are really beginning to address some of the questions as to why our ancestors might have been building these pyramids. And I think it's going to be an insightful and a revelatory kind of approach and hopefully refreshing and hopefully interesting. So those are kind of like some of the big things I'm working on. But as usual, there are 15 and sometimes they feel like 15,000 other subjects which I'm involved with at any given moment in time.
Well, I'm sure that our audience will be interested in all of the above and everything else that you have coming out in the future. And we're so glad that you could spend some time with us. One last thing. Where can people find your website again?
Well, the website obviously is on the web, which is philipcoppens.com, PHILIPCOPPENS. If people want to follow me on a more daily or on a more less character-based intensity, they can go to my Twitter, which is twitter.com/PhilipCoppens. If they want to follow me on Facebook instead, they can go to facebook.com/CoppensPhilip. So basically last name, first name there. And basically if you go on YouTube, you can find out about some of the interviews I've been given with your good self, but also with various other shows and organizations. But basically head to my website, philipcoppens.com, and all of those pieces of information you will find there as well.
Well, be sure to do that and also put a link at jimherold.com. Philip Coppens, continued success. Thank you for joining us today on the Paranormal Podcast.
Thanks for having me, Jim.
And thank you for tuning in, and we will talk to you next time. Have a great week, everybody. Happy Halloween.
Now for the legal disclaimer. We do not accept money from publishers or content producers in exchange for interviews. However, as with most media outlets, in the majority of cases, we do receive complimentary copies of books and DVDs that we feature on our podcasts. Your purchases of books, DVDs, and other items via our Amazon.com links benefit Jim Harold and JimHarold.com and help us continue our programming. The sponsor messages you hear on the programs are paid endorsements, although we really do like them. For the full disclaimer, go to JimHarold.com, and thanks for listening.